Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fulleylove, the Executive Director here, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's event with the Shadow Defence Minister, the Honourable Richard Marles MP. This is Richard's second speech to the Institute, but his first speech as Shadow Defence Minister to us. And interestingly, he's chosen to speak today not on defence matters narrowly, but on our immediate region, the Pacific. Here at the Lowy Institute, we are very interested in the Pacific because we know it is central to our interests. For many years, we had a strong Pacific program directed by our colleague and friend Jenny Hayward-Jones, who's now a non-resident fellow at the Institute. And the program, equally strong today, is led by my colleague Jonathan Pryke. The Pacific has been an important part of the Institute's research agenda for over a decade. We've produced influential work on the Ramsey mission to Solomon Islands, relations with Fiji and with Papua New Guinea, and the future challenges of PNG and the region. We've hosted Pacific leaders, including the Prime Ministers of PNG and Solomon Islands, and a number of ministers from Pacific countries. And our current research priorities in this region include foreign assistance flows in the Pacific, people-to-people links between Australia and PNG, labour mobility in the Pacific, and the state of the Pacific economies. So it's an issue, Richard, of which we are very seized. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Marles hails from Geelong and was educated at the University of Melbourne. He worked as a solicitor before becoming an official at the Transport Workers Union and the ACTU. He was elected to the House of Representatives for the Division of Corio in 2007. In the Rudd and Gillard governments, he served as Parliamentary Secretary for Innovation and Industry, Pacific Island Affairs and Foreign Affairs before being appointed Trade Minister. In opposition, he served as Shadow Minister for Immigration and Border Protection from 2013. And in 2016, he became the Shadow Minister for Defence. Ladies and gentlemen, not all Australian politicians, I'm afraid to say, care about the Pacific. Not all MPs visit the Pacific. But Richard is certainly part of that important cohort who do care. I believe I'm right that he first visited PNG on a school trip in 1984. He's been back many times. In his first speech to the Parliament, he urged Australia to engage more deeply with Papua New Guinea. And we're delighted to be hearing from Richard today on the topic Australia and the Pacific, a question of identity. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Richard Marles. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael, and can I start by saying what a pleasure it is to be here at the Lowy Institute and also start by paying my respects to the Indigenous owners of the land on which we meet and acknowledging their elders past and present. Makeshift dwellings are tightly packed into what little land exists. Amidst these homes wind tight dirt lanes the width of a car. This is a place of dense human existence. Space on a coral atoll is in short supply. There is rubbish strewn around liberally. It is clear the battle for effective waste management was lost a long time ago. Plumbing is sporadic. The electricity supply looks like it has been hooked up with ingenuity, but safety, not so much. And then you see a set of steps descending into a dark concrete space. Whatever this is, the sense is of ruin. And yet it's clear someone lives in there. The unmistakable stench of a human living without a toilet surrounds the entrance. That a person could be left with this dark hole in the ground in the middle of such a despairing landscape as a choice to lay their head at night deeply challenges your understanding of the ways life on this earth can be led. I've seen refugee camps in Africa, slums in Bangladesh, but the worst human circumstances I've ever witnessed are here, on the island of Bacio, in South Tarawa, Kiribati. And yet the biggest development assistance partner in the country for Kiribati is Australia. The most significant relationship Kiribati has with any nation is not China nor America. It's with us. Indeed, Kiribati's currency is the Australian dollar. So why is it that the plight of Bacio, its overcrowding, its challenges with health, its existential battle against the effects of climate change, is not a glaring part of the landscape which ought to be instinctively understood by every member of Parliament and every person within our foreign and security policy community. And yet it is not. Among the many issues that matter in our lives, it appears this is not one of them. But there was a time when Baisho mattered greatly. It was at the centre of the greatest global struggle in history. 74 years ago to this day, the Battle of Tarawa saw the single biggest beach landing of World War II up until that point. The lessons learnt there would be applied at Normandy within a year. Over four horrific days of conflict, almost 6,400 people would die in the struggle to take Baisho, which was then being used by the Japanese as an airbase. Four Congressional Medals of Honour would be won there, three of them posthumously. And a documentary with the Marines at Tarawa on the way to winning an Academy Award would shock homeland America for the first time about the true horrors of the war. Today on Baisho, there are still reminders of the battle. Rusted landing craft in the lagoon, a wreck of a tank in the village, and the dilapidated concrete bunkers, which now provide the saddest of homes. To see Baisho is politicising. It asks many questions. And in the process, it demands one simple answer in clear and indefatigable terms. Baisho was worth fighting for then, and in a very different way, Australia needs to fight for Baisho and indeed all of the Pacific now. Australia has a significant presence in the Pacific. We are easily the largest donor, providing $1.1 billion of assistance this year. We have far and away the largest diplomatic footprint in the region, with resident missions in 10 of the 15 other Pacific Island Forum nations, as well as consulates in Noumea and Hawaii. In addition to our deep defence relationship with New Zealand, we have large defence cooperation programs with other militaries in the region, PNG, Fiji and Tonga, which in each case is the largest defence assistance these nations receive. The Pacific Patrol Boat Program provides at least one vessel to all the Pacific Island Forum nations, except obviously New Zealand, Niue and Nauru. The PACER Plus Trade Agreement provides trade on favourable terms to the Pacific. The Seasonal Workers Program offers opportunities for persons in the region to access the Australian labour market. Make no mistake, Australia commits resources to the Pacific. Yet, for all this, there is no strategy or guiding philosophy about our role in the Pacific other than a general sense of obligation about providing help. To be sure, help is important, but it is not enough. Our relationship with the Pacific actually operates under a separate provision of our Constitution. Subsection 5129 of the Constitution furnishes the Commonwealth with powers in relation to external affairs. This is the well-known foreign policy head of power. Less well-known is subsection 5130, which provides the Commonwealth with powers regarding the relations of the Commonwealth with the islands of the Pacific. As long ago as the 1890s, when the Constitution was being framed, it was understood that our relationship with the Pacific was special. Yet the significance of the Pacific then, warranting its own head of constitutional power, is hardly reflected by its place in the thinking of Australian foreign and security policy now. While the main game is our relationship with the United States or China, the Pacific is relegated to a sort of niche area, well behind Southeast Asia, or for that matter, Europe and the Middle East. Indeed, you would be hard-pressed to find a parliamentarian today who wouldn't offer a view about Israel, Palestine and the two-state solution. And it certainly is a critical issue. Anyone with even a passing interest in international relations will be thinking about it. But it is quite a long way from Australia, and we are hardly the most important nation in its resolution. At the same time, in any given federal cabinet, over the last 40 years, only a handful of ministers would have been able to articulate the concerns and challenges facing Papua New Guinea right on our doorstep. And yet the very creation of that nation involved Australian cabinet decision-making. This sense of place, or rather the lack of it, that the Pacific holds in our worldview is not limited to the political class. Too many DFAT graduates dream of an initial European posting. It is the minority who chase an opportunity in the Pacific. Our media outlets have correspondents around the world, including in the United States, Europe, China, Japan, and Africa. And yet today, only the ABC maintains one journalist in Port Moresby, and that is the sum total of the Australian media contingent in the Pacific beyond New Zealand. Even our voice to the region, Radio Australia, was switched off with little or no notice in many of the Pacific Island countries. And at the people-to-people level, less and less Australians are getting a taste for the region, as cheap flights mean they can now choose Asia and beyond for their holidays. In my experience, the considerable resource commitment on the one hand, and yet the lack of vision and debate on the other, has led to an Australian holding pattern policy in the Pacific. Australia should be able to articulate a direction and a way forward for the Pacific, and yet we don't. The need to take the Pacific out of a holding pattern and to develop a strategy is first and foremost because the Pacific matters to us. It is our most immediate neighbourhood. PNG, a country of nearly 7 million people, is right on our doorstep, literally. The Torres Strait Treaty enables a free movement of locals across the Torres Strait for traditional activities, including fishing, such that there are some Papua New Guineans living in the Western Province who effectively commute to work each day to Boigu Island in Australia. Cairns is an important part of life the senior figures in PNG, involving frequent visits for pleasure and increasingly for business. Advance Cairns, a regional advocacy body, identifies building the relationship with PNG as one of the key economic opportunities for far north Queensland. For Melanesia and southern Micronesia, Brisbane is the principal transport hub. Regional leaders are constantly passing through on their way to the wider world. And even Polynesia via New Zealand has a significant connection to Australia, which is evidenced by the growing communities in both Sydney and Brisbane. The Pacific is key to our national security. The significant history in the region around our war history ought to provide a clue to that. PNG is, of course, home to Kokoda and Milne Bay, among other battle sites. The pilgrimages to these places are at least one way in which the profile of PNG in Australia has enjoyed an upswing. The Bamana War Cemetery is the largest Australian war cemetery in the world, with almost 4,000 Australian Defence Force personnel buried there. This alone makes this sacred ground for our country. The Battle of Guadalcanal, fought principally by the US Marines, happened in Solomon Islands. And as I've mentioned, in addition to Tarawa, other parts of Micronesia were the scene of conflict during the Second World War. To this day, the US military still has a number of strategic bases in Micronesia, including in Guam and Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands. In a more contemporary sense, instability in the countries would have and has had a huge bearing on our national security. We've seen major Australian defence commitments made to Bougainville and Solomon Islands in the last 20 years, in addition to our commitment to East Timor. These have resulted in Australian casualties and billions of dollars of expenditure. In the case of Bougainville, thousands of Bougainvillians lost their lives in the bloodiest conflict in the Pacific since World War II. There remain a worrying large number of small arms throughout PNG, a country which suffers from major law and order issues. While democracy throughout the Pacific has been a strength, military coups in Fiji over the last three decades remind us that it cannot be taken for granted. By virtue of the Pacific, Australia is actually the first world country which is surrounded by the most developing countries, all of whom face challenges and need help. By reference to all the social indicators described in the UN Sustainable Development Goals, such as eradicating extreme poverty and hunger, universal primary education, gender equality, child mortality, maternal health, and combating HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, the Pacific is a part of the world that faces huge struggles. Accordingly, they rightly are the major focus of our development assistance. And the Pacific is a massive piece of global territory. Its ecological significance and its economic potential are enormous. Establishing the right balance between these two tensions needs the active and smart stewardship of countries with resources and capability. But most importantly, the Pacific is that part of the world in which our influence matters the greatest. What we say and do in the Pacific carries enormous weight. In many instances, our influence is determinative. Our influence derives from being a first world economy of relative size located within the region. We have both a significant military history and a significant governance history in the region, with two countries, Papua New Guinea and Nauru, having gained their independence from us. Critically, the countries of the Pacific expect us to lead. They supported us fully when we sought a seat on the United Nations Security Council. Far from being concerned that Australia might be overbearing, what the Pacific Island nations fear most is a lack of attention from Australia. The appetite and desire for Australia to play its role with empathy and intelligence is manifest. And when we don't, or when we don't uphold our responsibility to speak with a Pacific voice, as has been the case on climate change in recent years, our reputation suffers. The expectation of the Pacific Island countries for us to lead is matched by the expectations of the world. Across the very broad bilateral relationship that we enjoy with the United States, mostly and understandably, it is America that takes the lead. They are a global superpower. We are not. Yet in one area, the US unambiguously follows us, the Pacific. It is therefore the one opportunity we have across the entirety of the relationship to demonstrate Australia as a leader. And it's in this sense that the Pacific is not only important in its own terms, but it also goes to the heart of the most important bilateral relationship that we have. And this is true not only in relation to the US, but also in respect to the world at large. The Pacific, whether we understand it or not, is our global calling card. And rightly, we will be judged, for good or for ill, on what we do or what we do not do in the Pacific. Our behaviour toward the Pacific is completely central to our international reputation. And so it's for this reason that we must stop seeing the Pacific as a niche area of foreign and security policy. Precisely because the Pacific goes to our key relationships with the likes of the United States and China, it is as centrally important to our worldview as is the United States and China. And given the progress of the Pacific is so important to how we are viewed, it is important to be clear-eyed in our assessment about that progress. Because the fact is, the Pacific is not travelling that well. It performed the worst of any region against the Millennium Development Goals. In 2015, Africa as a whole was on track to attain 3 of the 8 Millennium Development Goals: universal primary education, gender equality, and combating HIV, AIDS, and other diseases. The same cannot be said of the Pacific, where only 2 countries, the Cook Islands and Niue, achieved all the Millennium Development Goals, and 3 countries, Kiribati, PNG, and Solomon Islands, did not achieve any. In the 2015 progress chart, Northern Africa showed poor progress or deterioration against 2 measures in the Millennium Development Goals, whereas Oceania showed poor progress or deterioration in 5 measures. North Africa was shown to be on target or have made excellent progress against 7 measures, compared to just 1 for the Oceania region. As a relative measure of development, between the year 2000 and 2015, this shows the Pacific as the slowest developing region in the world. It suggests that in the not too distant future, Africa will overtake the Pacific in development, leaving the Pacific as the least developed region in the world. From health to education, to law and order, to the empowerment of women, the Pacific needs help, and business as usual is clearly not acceptable. The Pacific is on the front line of climate change as well. An intrinsic feature of small island nations is that economies are narrow. They are heavily reliant on tourism, agriculture, and aquaculture, and all of that means the natural environment. As this changes and is threatened, so too are the livelihoods that depend upon it. And with very little manufacturing to compensate, the impact on economies can be devastating. The situation is even more acute in coral atoll nations such as Kiribati, Tuvalu, and the Marshall Islands. For countries that consist of thin strips of land only a few metres above sea level, climate change is an existential issue. Its impact is happening now. And Bill Shorten and Tanya Plibersek saw this for themselves when we visited the Marshall Islands and Kiribati in the lead up to the Paris Climate Conference back in 2015. Sea level rises have the potential to make entire atolls uninhabitable. But well prior to that point, the security of water supply will be critically threatened. In Tuvalu, the water supply is rainwater captured in tanks. This works because of a highly predictable pattern of rain in a tropical climate. But at the end of 2011, just a small change in rainfall created a water crisis as water supplies reduced to just a couple of days. Small changes in weather patterns had a major impact. Similarly in Tarawa, more than half of the groundwater supply is now spoilt. During big storms, the water lens, the groundwater, becomes brackish. While there is a natural process that flushes out the brackish water, the frequency of storms has made it impossible for this to fully happen. An age-old local custom is to welcome dignitaries by having them drink at the local well. At the Eta Maniaba, this custom is performed as a welcome to the country itself. It is where important visitors receive a traditional welcome to Kiribati. Sadly, the well at Eta Maniaba is spoiled, meaning the ceremony is now conducted using a coconut. I've witnessed this ceremony on many occasions. It is centuries old. And when I first learned about the use of the coconut instead of the well, it felt to me as poignant an example of the effects of climate change as any I'd seen. Perhaps most significantly is the impact on the psyche of these countries. For each of Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Marshall Islands, the sea has historically been a source of sustenance and security. But now this source of security has become a source of threat. And the resulting reality that each of these countries faces the real possibility as to whether they will exist within the lifetime of the current generation has a massive impact on people's happiness in the here and now. The poor pace of development combined with the threats posed by climate change provide a worrying assessment of the Pacific. And this assessment reflects on us. The world will rightly hold Australia to account for our development assistance efforts and our advocacy or lack of it in respect of climate change. In considering our actions in the Pacific, often I feel there is an instinct not to act in the manner of an overbearing colonial power, to proceed on the basis of a light touch. This sentiment is well motivated, but it's wrong. And moreover, it risks becoming an excuse for inaction. In my experience, a sensitivity about a perception of Australia being overbearing could not be more misplaced. Indeed, the perception is actually the opposite. Governments in the Pacific want Australia to pay some attention. And this is more than simply wanting action on the part of the government of Australia. It is also about wanting airtime in the Australian public discourse. I genuinely believe that among the countries of the region, there is a real appetite for Australian leadership. Accordingly, while we have no right, and nor would we ever seek to impose our plans on the Pacific, we should have an obligation to make a pledge to the Pacific, to lead a Pacific discussion. And there are two ideas which I believe could be the cornerstone for developing such a pledge, which may be the basis of a discussion we could have with the Pacific Island countries. The first is a far more extensive and deeper defence relationship with those countries which have a defence force. Australia is the beneficiary of a deep defence relationship with the United States. At any point in time, hundreds of Australian Defence Force personnel are embedded within the US Armed Forces. They are given opportunities which could never be had within the ADF. They develop skills and capabilities which in turn empower the ADF when they come home. Some operate at a very high level within the chain of command, bringing back a well-developed sense of how the Defence Force of our major ally operates. A version of the opportunities we derive from this defence relationship with the US could be provided by us to the defence forces of the Pacific. In the same way we derive a benefit from the US, the Pacific Island countries could derive a benefit from us. And just as it suits the US to have a more capable Australian defence force, so too it would benefit us to see the capability of the Pacific Island countries' defence forces grow. Already, we do much in this space. Many in the officer ranks of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force and the Republic of Fiji military forces have had extensive training in Australia. The links are very strong. The Pacific Patrol Boat Program, which provides both vessels and Royal Australian Navy maritime surveillance advisors, is the only maritime capability that many of the Pacific Island countries have. It is a huge commitment, which is gratefully received and provides assets and builds skills. But rather than seeing these efforts as a role already performed, we should see them instead as a guide to how much further down this path we could go. And the important point to understand is that it is actually in our national interest to walk this path as far as the Pacific Island countries are willing to walk it with us. The more capable, the more professional, the more interoperable these forces are with our own, the more stable these countries will be, and the better chance development is given to flourish. The second is looking at ways in which Australia could extend its government action to assist the functions of government in the Pacific. For many small island states in the Pacific, the sorts of functions of government which we take for granted in Australia can only be performed if effort is aggregated with other small island states. The provision of tertiary education is an example. For most Pacific Island states, on their own, running a public university is far beyond the capacity of any single government. But together, a number of the countries of the Pacific have banded together to run the University of South Pacific, which is a multinational public university. The aggregation of government service delivery is part of the global small island state story, for it is a feature of how small island states operate in the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean as well. An extension of this concept is Australia using its government service delivery to perform functions for the Pacific Island countries. We do this now in a small way. The airspace above Nauru is managed by Air Services Australia, and income derived from it is used to maintain the airport on Nauru. Similarly, the High Court of Nauru is the High Court of Australia. Provided this is done sensitively and offered on a basis which completely empowers the Pacific Island countries, it can only ever occur if the nations themselves want it to occur, then the scope for this assistance is enormous. It can make a huge difference to the development of these countries, particularly in respect of deriving a proper benefit from their chief asset, their maritime exclusive economic zones. Our assistance would be our pledge to be the best friend that we possibly can be. In terms of articulating Australia's pledge to the Pacific, a step change in our defence cooperation and Australian pledges for shared government service delivery is a place to start. The consequences of developing a way forward for the Pacific is vital in terms of the well-being of the peoples of the Pacific, but it would also have a profound impact on Australia's strategic circumstances. It would greatly improve our national security framework. It would be the natural and necessary extension of our active participation as a good global citizen with the United Nations, our alliance with the United States, and our defence cooperation with the countries of Southeast and East Asia. It would be the active promotion of security within the region where we lead. To be clear, previous efforts such as those in Solomon Islands and Bougainville have been very important and examples of Australian security policy at its best. But whereas those were reactive in nature, this would seek to proactively create a better security environment in the spirit of prevention being better than a cure. Demonstrating that Australia is actively thinking about the future of the Pacific and developing ideas for improving it can only help in encouraging the US to be a part of the Indo-Pacific for the long term. While I believe that reports of an American retreat from East Asia are very premature, it is clearly in Australia's national interest that the US remain, and so measures which encourage the US to stay matter. America's alliances in East Asia help root the US in our region. Australia is key among these. We are already dependable, reliable, and pull our weight. This is critical. But so too is demonstrating that in Australia, the US has a partner willing to lead and willing to share the burden of developing strategy for the region. Making a pledge to the Pacific would also let the rest of the world know that we are serious about our responsibilities in the Pacific and mean to be present. Pacific Island countries have choices about with whom they partner. That we will always be the partner of choice is not a proposition that we can take for granted. The country that cares the most will have the biggest impact. A Pacific pledge would demonstrate that that country is Australia. Our failure to embrace our leadership role in the Pacific is the biggest blind spot in Australia's national security policy. Why don't we eagerly lead where we are expected to lead? There are 10 countries whose principal relationship in the world is with Australia. For those of us who are interested in the national security and foreign policy space, why can't we name those countries as a matter of reflex? To me, it speaks to a bigger issue. Our sense of national mission needs to be enhanced. We are a well-liked, competent, friendly country that plays its part in the world. It's an enviable basis for our international relations. But who we are and what we are on about are questions rarely asked and rarely answered. While our Indigenous population has millennia of history behind it, the new world immigrant country that characterises much of Australia today does not. We do not have the history of Britain or France, which is central to their national missions, nor have we ever had an independence movement like the US, or for that matter, the countries of the Pacific themselves. Our becoming a nation during the Second World War did not yield a national discussion which we can look back to in order to illuminate a national mission. And so as a new world country which never had an independence movement, we are left with some thinking still to do. The absence of this thought is not to say we have security policy all wrong, far from it. Nor is it to say that engaging in it will lead to a security policy revolution. It won't. But it is to say that without this thinking, we have some blind spots. And engaging in it would help to illuminate them, such as the role we need to play in the Pacific. Acting as a leader in the Pacific and articulating why will help promote that discussion and stimulate that thinking. It would correct a deficiency in our national security policy, and it would represent a maturing of our nationhood. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard, for a really well-argued speech that I'm sure will be read closely in coming days. We've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions. Let me ask you the first one. You focused on the Pacific, the region where Australia is the most influential power, the most important power, the metropolitan power. But of course, Australia has a whole range of other interests that you didn't touch on, including an alliance relationship with the United States, attempting to maintain a liberal international order when the President of the United States is not liberal or internationally minded or orderly in his behaviour, grappling with the very difficult question of the relationship with China at a time when China is being much more forward-leaning, maintaining our links with Southeast Asia at a time when Southeast Asian capitals are trying to work out how to deal with China. A long-term historical involvement in the Middle East, where Australian governments of both colours have often seen fit to deploy troops to the Middle East. So there's a whole range of interests that Australia has in the world. If the opposition becomes the government and you become the defence minister, let me ask you, where would the Pacific sit in that hierarchy of interests? You've made an argument to us today that it's underdone at the moment, but how would you balance this, which after all would take your attention, would take resources, would take money, would take personnel, with these other questions of the global order, relations with China, with Southeast Asia, the insurance policy with the alliance and so on?
Sure. It's a good question. And obviously, you know, I wanted today to focus on the Pacific and make that argument and kind of make that argument in exclusion to all else, because it's an argument which, in my view, deserves to be made. In other forums, I've obviously spoken about what is the critical strategic circumstances that we face, how we see the rise of China, how we see the ongoing relationship with the United States, our place, as you say, within Southeast Asia. All of these are critical, and it's not to diminish them. But I think the answer to the question ultimately is to understand where the Pacific fits, not just in terms of a kind of, you know, a weighting or you know, giving each of these entities a kind of mark out of 10 and then working out which one you focus on, but understanding how it all fits together, because that leads then to the answer of what emphasis you place upon it. You know, for me, there was a significant penny that dropped when I was doing work in the Pacific as the PALSEC for Pacific Island Affairs, and then transitioning from that in a way or building on that to perform a role in helping campaign for Australia to become a member of the United Nations Security Council. And in that, having a lot to do with the United States. And the idea that what we did in the Pacific actually was central to our relationship with the rest of the world is the point that we really need to understand. What I'm trying to say here is that in many respects, all of what I've articulated can be seen through the prism of our relationship with the US. I mean, if we just want to do the relationship with the US right, we have to do the Pacific, because it is the one place where they come to us and say, what would you like us to do? We will follow you. It's how we demonstrate to them what we look like as a leader, that we are a dependable, reliable ally that pulls its weight, but we are something more. That something more we can only demonstrate in the Pacific. So if you only wanted to think about the world in terms of the United States and our relationship with it, it would demand extra attention in the Pacific. But beyond that, if that analysis can apply to all the critical relationships that we have. A version of that analysis you can apply in terms of how we see our growing relationship with China, how we see our relationship within Southeast Asia. What was really interesting to me is I represented Australia twice at meetings of the African Union, and in the process met 2012-13 just about all but one of the foreign ministers of the African countries. And in a huge number of those meetings, they were asking me about how things were going in the Pacific and what we were doing there. It was really interesting. This is our global calling card, and the world understands it. It's just that at times we don't. It's not about a sort of a relative sense of needing to do more in the Pacific against others. It is about, if we want to take our place in the world, we need to be active in our backyard, because that is the ticket to taking our place in the world. And it's that shift in thinking which you know, I hope a future Labor government would engage in, but frankly, it's bigger than that. That's a shift in thinking that all of us need to. The commentariat, our media, our defence forces, DFAT, our bureaucracy. We're missing something here. And it's deeply important that we figure this out. Because I do think if we don't, it is going to affect the kinds of ways in which we relate to the rest of the world going forward and achieving the sorts of things that we seek to achieve.
Thank you. Let me call on Anna Kirk from the Lowy Institute.
Hello. Thank you for your speech today. My name is Anna Kirk and I'm the Project Director of the Australia Papua New Guinea Network. I wanted to ask, I think a lot of us who work on the Pacific would agree with you that Australians do not have a very strong understanding of our region and the complexity of our relationship with a lot of these countries. How do you think that we could build Pacific literacy in Australia?
Maybe the starting point there is that those of us who have a passion about this, which clearly you and I do, also have an obligation. If we're not talking about it, no one is. So I think it's really important that we start exercising our voice. For me, and it's why, it's one thing to exercise your voice as the Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island Affairs, and it was a wonderful experience for me, and obviously, as is I hope evident from what I've said today, completely fell in love with the place, but I'd, in truth, fallen in love with it well before then, and it was something of a dream job that I had. But it's another to articulate the same messages as the Shadow Minister for Defence and, I hope one day potentially as the Minister for Defence. The Pacific needs to be elevated out of the niche and into the mainstream. Part of why I referred to the Constitution at the start is because there is a lost truth in this. This is something that was understood in our past, which we don't understand as well today. And I think PNG is a really good example where, of a sort of an older generation, perhaps emanating out of the Second World War, there was a huge affection and a lot of thought given to PNG, which is not experienced now. So I think coming back to it, those of us who have passion need to argue the case. There are obligations everywhere. The media has obligations. I've told this story a number of times, but it was an ongoing battle for me to try and get the Today Show, which at that point broadcast into, and I think it's different now, but at that point, so back in 2012, was broadcasting into PNG on two stations, Impaja and MTV, which is the private-owned TV station in Port Moresby. You got the Today Show in the morning. I was really keen for the Today Show to just do one thing. Tell us what the weather was going to be every morning in Port Moresby. And it's not that hard because it's the same every single day. I went to Channel 9 to ask them to do that. I got all sorts of answers back about, intellectual property and it's a bit hard to do this here and we'd need to get access. You're kidding me. Just tell us what the temperature is going to be in Port Moresby every morning. Firstly, you've got a viewership which is watching you. You should treat it with respect. Advertisements are being sold off the back of your program in Port Moresby. You should treat those people with respect. If you did it, you would let people in Australia know that there is an island north of Cape York. If you did it, you would provide the opportunity of one day actually doing the weather from Port Moresby. And then maybe you could do a show from Port Moresby leading up to Anzac Day. But just start by telling us the weather. Now that, I failed. But I think, we've got to encourage, I really hope one day our media does that. I would like to see News Limited, and they have a particular role as owners of the Post Courier, to have more exchanges between journalists in the Post Courier and journalists on publications here. I don't really get why when you see store, and I kind of live in News Limited world given I come from Geelong and the Geelong Advertiser was a News Limited paper, so I'm like News Limited. It's an unusual thing for a Labor person to say, but that's fine. You see more and more stories shared throughout the News Limited network. That makes sense, except stories from the Post Courier. Like, why can't we get more stuff from PNG in the Telegraph? I mean, it is a really interesting country. Amazing stuff happens there. It's very newsworthy. So I do think that there is a kind of a campaign that we need to run at all levels. And obviously in the speech that I gave, I also think it's really important at a bureaucratic level that, greater encouragement is given to, up-and-comers in DFAT, for example, that not just a great place but almost the most important place to start your career is in the Pacific. Deeply frustrating to speak to a room full of, DFAT graduates and hear about aspirations of serving in a European capital. That's great. Europe's important. Port Moresby's more important, and that's where they should go.
Hello. Shadow Minister Richard Broinowski, I was General Manager of Radio Australia in the early 90s and at some stages in the 80s. And up to that time, such was our influence that we used to, the Fijians would stop their cabinet minister meetings to listen to what the Radio Australia news. I read also a summary of what you were going to say in The Australian this morning. And it seems to me that you say, look, if we don't get in there and do more, then other countries will fill the vacuum. We have American admirals coming here frequently, brass hats, who advise us on what to do in the South China Sea. And yet you say they take the lead from us in the Pacific. I wonder if that is really true. But let me ask you, if and when you become government, how are you going to handle the Chinese expansion into what is their literal region, including the Pacific? Do you envisage having some definite meetings, an exchange with the Chinese so that you understand each other? Or is it something that you feel, no, we have to simply go it alone and work in the Pacific by ourselves?
So I think your question begs two answers about the Pacific and more generally. So let me start with the more general. We welcome the rise of China. China is not the Soviet Union. We have benefited enormously in economic terms from the rise of China, and it ought to be embraced. In saying that, obviously, the sort of China that we want to encourage is a peaceful China, but a China which embraces and contributes to a global rules-based order. Now, you know, I think, to be frank, there are anxieties in terms of what's occurred in the South China Sea, which is, you know, which we need to be thinking very carefully about. And it does mean being upfront and honest with the Chinese about our concerns in respect of that, about what our national interests there are, for example, which is clearly, you know, freedom of navigation, given so much of our trade goes through the South China Sea. So I think having an honest and frank relationship which does articulate our national interests with, you know, without compromise is important. It's also important, though, to acknowledge that we benefit from the rise of China. In the background of all of that, of course, is also the fact that I think that our relationship, our alliance with the United States, is as relevant today as it has ever been. And I'm a huge supporter of the alliance, as people in this room would know, and probably represent kind of one end of the spectrum of thought in respect of that, and see the US's presence in East Asia as critically important going forward. So that's the kind of the attitude, if you like, to China in the general. In the more specific about China's place in the Pacific, firstly, we don't have exclusive rights in the Pacific. We can't, you know, any notion that we can kind of say to the Pacific, you can only be friends with us is silly and counterproductive. The Pacific have a right to make whatever relationships they want and be friends with whoever they want. And I think it's completely natural that they would seek to build relationships with China, and I don't criticise any of the countries in the Pacific for that at all. But the point I do make is this. Who cares the most in the Pacific is the country that will have the biggest influence and the most determining outcome. Who cares the most? And the idea that we would not be that country, I find amazing. It is absolutely essential that Australia places itself as the country which sees itself as the country which has the biggest focus on the Pacific of any first world country in the world. Now, let me also say that there is a degree to which we obviously do that in partnership with New Zealand. I think encouraging the French, who are a Pacific country as well, to play a bigger role is something we need to do. But Australia needs to make a pledge to the Pacific so that it is absolutely clear that the country that is caring the most is us.
Well, on Jemima Garrett, who certainly has put the Pacific first in her career. Jemima.
Well, having worked in the Pacific for 30 years, I'd have to say this is refreshing and not before time and absolutely music to my ears, because it's so needed. My question is around how you implement it. In particular, to what extent have you had talks with Penny Wong about this, and how would it pan out if Labor were to become government? And also in two particular areas. One is tuna fishing, where the Pacific is the global power. 56% of the world's tuna is caught in the Pacific, and Australia is part of those negotiations. And how do you see that working, and what role for defence in terms of things like surveillance, monitoring, control and surveillance? And secondly, a more thorny one, climate change is really starting to tell in relations between Australia and the Pacific over coal. And, you know, how do you see that panning out in terms of domestic policy in Australia, so that we have something to go as a partnership with the Pacific that, you know, is something that they'll find acceptable?
Well, first let me say, Penny has a very strong commitment to the Pacific, and one of the very first trips that she made as Shadow Foreign Minister was to the region, and she's now been there a number of times. So, you know, that you know, for me, is a great thing to see. It's obviously hard to go into a whole lot of detail now about how you would go about these things, but I do think that the two sort of areas of activity which I flagged represent the most fertile ground for elevating, in a practical sense, what we do in the Pacific. I didn't mention development assistance and in terms of the future, and that's not to say we wouldn't do it. It's more a reflection of the fact that we do a lot now, and I think we do development assistance well. But I do think the defence cooperation with defence forces of the region, I think, is really important, and I genuinely believe, as I said, that there is room to enhance that significantly. And I say all of that acknowledging the significant amount that's already done, but the point is not to see it as we do enough already, but rather we could do it. This indicates we could do a lot more. The idea of government service delivery and leveraging that to perhaps perform some of that for countries of the Pacific, I think, is also a critical area where a lot can be achieved. You know, I was asked this morning whether that is in some respects counterproductive, because this was on Radio Australia, because, you know, shouldn't we be talking about countries in the Pacific standing on their own two feet? Well, yes, we should, but there is I think we need to better understand the small island nation story around the world. The aggregation of government services is a real feature of the story of countries, not just in the Pacific, but in the Caribbean, in the Indian Ocean as well. All sorts of government services, when you're talking about very small populations in very remote parts of the world, end up being aggregated as the only way in which public functions can be delivered. We can play more of a part there. And I think the exclusive economic zones is particularly a place where we can play more of a part. And when I... And I don't think with necessarily an additional huge amount of cost. When I was in Funafuti, for example, and looked in the lagoon there, and there was a fishing vessel which had been apprehended with one of the patrol boats that we provided. The penalty, the fine that would be yielded from a successful prosecution of the fishing company would be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to Tuvalu, which for them, given the size of the population, is a lot of money. And yet the complete impracticality of going through that prosecution, you just look at it and think that this is crazy. Like, you're 90% of the way there in terms of what you need to do. You've actually apprehended a vessel. You've discovered they've illegally fished. You've brought them here. You can't do the final bit. It begs the question. And I've found questions like that pose themselves all around the Pacific, which is not directly development assistance, but I actually don't think is that hard for us to do. And then you discover that there are examples of us doing it in small ways, but we are doing it. We're doing it in Nauru. I think we do it in Solomons as well. I think that air services example I gave is something that we do, I stand to be corrected on that, but in Solomons as well. There are lots of ways in which that could, with some wit, we could go through that, and I think, you know, a whole lot of things could be thought through there, which I reckon would make a huge difference, and which right now, you know, we're not acting upon enough.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know some others have been trying to get my attention today. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. So apologies to those people who were trying to catch my attention. Let me say, Richard, that the big difference often between a speech that's really powerful and one that's not is belief. And it's impossible to listen to what you say and not realize that you're a believer in this stuff, that you show enormous familiarity with it and real passion with it. It's obviously a theme of your public life. And today I think you've given a very powerful speech on an important topic, and certainly one that is welcome to those of us who care about the Pacific. I'd like to thank you for that. Let me say, when I introduced Richard with his impressive biography, I left off one very important line item. He is the co-host of an important Sky TV program called Pine and Marls. The reason I mention that is that on the 13th of December, we'll be hosting your co-host, Christopher Pine, the Minister for Defence Industry. And on the 14th of December, we'll be hosting another former Liberal Party figure, Joe Hockey, now the ambassador in the United States, to give a one-year report card on President Trump. So, ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot more to come from Auspol in the next year, in the next month. But in the meantime, please join me in thanking Richard Marles for giving a really powerful and well-argued speech. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.